Okay, we're going to start this morning with music. Would you like to say anything about the song before we hear it? That might be helpful.
Well, sure. A lot of it comes from Touching Our Strength by Carter Hayward.
By what?
Carter Hayward.
Which one is of those right there in the middle.
Who wrote this song?
Okay.
And I heard it yesterday. It's a marvelous song about what we've been doing for 4 days in the class.
Okay, here it goes.
The cold and snowy evening with old and my roommates. I'm getting out, my stomach is jumping. There's another erotic tension warm in this cold room tonight. I am in a state of erotic confusion. My mind and my body just can't agree. Carter Hayward said these feelings are sacred. Well, that's all you tell me, baby. Self is saying
recordings like this published big time? Seriously, I think it's just a
how do you how do you own pocket?
Yeah, you can pay for a studio time, and then you find a, you know, usually it's a local distributor, gets someone to play airtime.
Yeah.
Generally helps if it's a bigger city.
Yeah.
But it can be done.
Was that you singing?
If they want to buy, is it possible to buy a copy of this tape here?
Not yet.
So if it happens, it would be in the newsletter and people could remember this and order it.
What a great idea.
Sure.
Okay. An announcement. You have to be out of your rooms by 10:30. And I will make that again at the end, because there's an influx, and apparently there are a lot of bugs going around in depleted numbers and staff. Anybody have dress codes? The tape?
Yes.
Good. So you'll get it back to me before I head
sure
off to Boston. Okay. I think that we will start today with Passover, because it is Passover. And I'm going to do this in response to two questions out of the list yesterday. Who is God in relationships? And what is cooperative power in sexual intercourse? I'm going to take the first half of that first. And is God in this discussion of sexuality? And is there something about spirituality in a biblical sense that might help us to deal with some of this? And I want to invite you to think while I'm reading this, just these two quick texts, to consider what kind of a God it is that you have. Of what sort is this God? Is this God reliable? Is this God like Gandhi? Or some other kind of God? Then Moses called all the elders of Israel and said to them, select lambs for yourself according to your families. That means the bigger the family, the more lambs. And kill the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop and dip it in the blood which is in the basin, and touch the lintel and the two doorposts with the blood which is in the basin, and none of you shall go out of the door of his house until the morning. For the Lord will pass through to slay the Egyptians. And when he sees the blood on the lintel and the two doorposts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not allow the destroyer to enter your houses to slay you. You shall observe this rite as an ordinance for you and for your sons forever. And when you come to the land which the Lord will give you, as he has promised, you shall keep this service. And when your children say to you, what do you mean by this service? You shall say, it is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, for he passed over the houses of the people of Israel in Egypt, when he slew the Egyptians, but spared our houses, that is our families. And the people bowed their heads in worship. And the people of Israel went out and did so, and as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron, so they did. At midnight, the Lord smote all the firstborn of the land of Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on his throne to the firstborn of the captive who was in the dungeon, and all the firstborn of the cattle. And Pharaoh rose up in the night, he and all his servants and all the Egyptians, and there was a great cry in Egypt, for there was not a house where one was not dead. And he summoned Moses and Aaron by night and said, rise up, go forth from among your people, both you and the people of Israel, and go and serve the Lord as you have said. Take your flocks and your herds as you have said, and get out, and bless me also. And that text, as you all well know, is at the base, then, of the text for this week in Christian tradition. Now the Feast of Unleavened Bread drew near, which is called the Passover. And the chief priests and the scribes were seeking how to put him to death, for they feared the people, etc. Question. if you knew only the text of the Passover and the Exodus, what would you say about God?
That he's cruel.
Beautiful.
Cruel. That he's cruel?
Cruel to kill that many children. You know, children that have nothing to say about being killed. Helpless.
I think he has favorites.
Mm-hmm. So he didn't kill them all? Or? What else was that?
God's eyes for the poor and the oppressed.
That's, this text is at the heart of liberation theology, isn't it? As well as the theology of Israel. God sides with the poor and the oppressed. And kills off the children of the rich. What's the parallel in the New Testament?
Good to those who hate you.
That's
the killing of the holy innocent.
That's one parallel. Is the killing of the holy innocents back in the at the birth end of Jesus' story? But in this in the Passover text for this week, what's the parallel? Remember the blood on the door?
The blood of Jesus.
Jesus is the Lamb whose blood keeps God the destroyer away.
Yeah.
That's what blood atonement means. Blood atonement protects us from the wrath of God. Now, my question is that a tenable theology for the late 20th century? And for some it is. Some in our group aren't participating anymore because they are upset that I don't adhere to blood atonement as a Christian. And I don't adhere to it because I am still deeply torn between this image of God as all-loving and God as violent as you can get on planet Earth. There is no other more violent power, or maybe nuclear holocaust, than a God who just goes through and wipes out whole categories of people. And the Bible is utterly full of that. And it ends in the book of Revelation. It's not that the Hebrew scripture is the nasty God and Christian scripture is the nice God. It's a consistent God picture that runs all the way through. And I raise this now because I invite you to ask yourselves the question, when you wonder about God in sexual relationships, when you wonder about God in intimacy, which version of God in the Bible are you using? How do we get this picture of God if we think that we have to rely on Scripture to do it? But there's another element of that, and that is this picture of Jesus. Is a sacrificial lamb helpful for your sexual ethics? Not at all. Anybody find it helpful?
Well, I, as a man, I would find it helpful in that, that he's the servant, that he serves, that he gives his life that other people could live. Similar to, we saw a movie Alive recently, and the bodies of their friends were given in order that others would live, so the ultimate sacrifice.
But let me push this a bit, in part because I struggle with this all the time myself, and as a question of faith, not simply a question of theology. What does that mean? He gave his life so that others may live. Is how does the metaphor of the sacrificial lamb out of Passover tradition help me live today?
Well, I mean, I repeat that the people that make community go, make community possible, are not so much the leaders as the servants, as the people who wash the dishes, prepare the food, raise the children, gather the food, build the houses. Those are the people that keep community alive.
Yeah,
I see that that's where the difference is between the idea of the sacrificing and the idea of cooperative power, where we in our society are so afraid of being selfish in our actions that we overvalue self-sacrifice for the common good. And it's still not that cooperative where we ourselves are able to enjoy the fruits of our labor.
Do you find Jesus helpful in articulating a view, in understanding the view of cooperative power?
I do. I really do. When we see him as coming and breaking all rules, all traditions, by meeting with this Samaritan woman, I think that he very much did.
And the breaking of the rules and traditions is the expression of that. Is that, I understand you? So the consequences, the relevance of that for your sexual moral life is what?
That I am just as equal as, to me.
Yes.
Okay. That I am just as important and just as equal as the man. And I think basically Jesus came and said, hey, listen, man, these people, these women are valuable. We need to listen to them and give them the value that they deserve.
So Jesus functions as liberator for you, liberator mm-hmm. from patriarchy.
Yes.
And what the blood on the doorpost may be protecting you from, to see if this symbol can work at all, is not the wrath of God, but the wrath of patriarchy. Is it possible that Jesus would protect from 1 Timothy understanding of marriage, to use an odd one to start with, or protect women from sexual harassment on the job? Protect women from rape? Is that...
Well, it boils down to ultimate respect. God is a scared human being for me. He was very... His punishment was severe. And his judgment was severe. And I'm banking and counting on Jesus being my salvation, because if I have to trust God, it's pretty scary. I might as well have given up a long time ago.
I think you're in great company. I think that many people understand God, as the tradition has said, that God is not only love, but God is just anger. And then Jesus is the blood protection between us and God, and God construed as a mighty warrior patriarch. So in some sense, if you want to be, if you want to have dignity and integrity as a woman, it might be that blood atonement theology is very useful over against this God. Because your dignity and integrity as a woman was not the issue in this text. Except, maybe, exceptionally.
Well, I think Jesus very often portrays the protector of women and the emancipator of the female, the woman with the well, the prostitute that was to be stoned. Mm-hmm. I think there's ever so many incidents.
The Syrophoenician woman, where he called her a dog. It's not exactly a wholly consistent picture there.
But I do think there's an equal amount of incidents where Jesus clearly stood on the woman's side.
See, I think the question of sexual ethics in Scripture is not a question of finding the sex text in Scripture. I think that is fruitless activity. Because you're extracting rules from a context which was about as different from ours as you could get. And it's saying, an example comes to mind. We have, in the neighborhood I live in, a lot of Russian Jewish immigrants and a lot of Haitian immigrants. And they cycle through the owning and managing a laundromat as they rise through middle class, to middle class ecstasy in America. And they have, one of the fascinating parts of this is to watch the signs that they put up in the laundromat in English. And there's one sign that says, American coins only, please take notice. They've seen the signs out in the public sphere that say, please take notice if there's like trespassing. And so they have somehow absorbed the idea that this is a good warning sign to put to protect against violations of the law, as if the police were going to regularly check people putting the coins in the laundromat. It's an example of taking the rule out of context, and it makes no sense where it is now. And the sexual rules of the Bible are so culture-specific and time-specific and patriarchy-specific that if we start applying them to our situation, we'll be in constant turmoil trying to figure out what in the world does this have to do with this situation now. And I'm being totally Lutheran when I'm saying this, because the criterion that Luther used was not sexual activities to find what is true about this text, but whether or not it conveys a vision of God other than the guy who's going to destroy you. Or does it drive us to the Christ, as Luther put it. And that's a very different way from asking the question of the Bible. What important thing does the Bible tell me about sexuality? It tells me I'm not inferior to men. Well, I can find enough passages that will do that. It also tells me that I am inferior to men.
It says that God created everybody equal.
Yeah, it also says that that we are derived out of the male. So, there is no consistent sexual ethic in the Bible. But there is a consistent witness about the situation of the oppressed. I don't think you can find one place in the Bible which says that God prefers the powerful, wealthy oppressor over the oppressed. I don't think it's there. That sounds preaching. Go ahead.
You know, when I get to the end of trying to figure things out theologically, I have to go on or back up to my own personal experience with God. And I think this has something to do with sexual ethics. I struggled for years not to divorce someone that I should never have married in the first place. And he was the victim of the pietistic Lutheran thing, you know. Well, anyway, when I finally decided that I was going to either end up dead, I mean, mentally or physically both, or divorce this person, I had to go through a long, serious amount of psychological counseling. And during that time, I had a vision. And the vision was that of Jesus nailing this divorce to the cross. And you know, that just stopped all of my guilt, all of my everything, and I was able to do it. And never have I lost a minute's sleep since. Not at all. And I have passed that on to women who have been victimized and victims of in these kinds of marriages. I was married 22 years. And then they say, oh, but I can't remarry. What about adultery? Blah, 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 blah. And I just tell them that story. And for me, that just covers it all. And that's my experience with God, not trying to figure him out. So I think that when we get to the end of ourselves and our own thinking, that we can ask God for insight, or he'll put us in situations where we'll receive it, and we won't have visions or thoughts, or, you know, when we're honestly inquiring. That makes sense to anybody?
You have to reach a point where you can trust your own feelings and your own thoughts.
Right, well, you sort of have to be empty of all this other stuff that says, I can't get divorced. If I remember saying this, I can't believe I said this now. At 43 years old, I went to my mother and said, do you think I'll go to hell if I get a divorce? You know, and yet I had been a Bible student. I really felt that that's when I became a Christian, a Christ person.
There is a wonderful, long-standing tradition of women having visions.
Is that right?
And visions that correct the patriarchally decided norm. Mm-hmm.
So I say God, or he put this on the cross, and that's for me and other women who have been mistreated in some way or another in marriage behind the guise of Lutheran Christianity.
There are young women and in seminary now, it's a wonderful occasion for this to become public. Young women who have had the vision that what the crucifixion was rape. And if Jesus the Christ has been raped, then he is someone who can understand their situation.
Yeah, that's good.
Jesus as the Christa, that was the sculpture that was developed, Jesus as a female crucified body, raises some real questions for people about how we understand what it means to be woman and God. So women have again and again and again and again had spirit visions, which is the way that we've survived, I think.
And you can't argue, no one can argue with you about it, because you've had the experience.
There are also visions that are demonic.
And then
one of developing sexual ethics for a new age is testing the spirit in community. The feminist principle in ethics is that you obtain an insight into the truth at the end of a communal process of conversation.
Well, I really did.
Yeah.
But it was just between myself and one other person. But it was the end of about a year and a half of intense kind of stuff.
But that means that we ought never to do sexual ethics by ourselves in isolation. We ought to try to do that, I think, is really dangerous, because you can end up, as somebody was talking the other day, so full of the conviction of your own insight into the truth that you become really deadly for other people. So a woman could have an insight that says that women must be subordinate to men. You know? We've got to test the insight no matter who has it. So the standard there is a community standard, and it may be simply a community of women, a community of feminists, a woman church gathering. Now, my dear friends, I have no idea where you want to move in our last period of conversation here. I find Holy Week just very difficult to deal with emotionally, so how would you like to address these other topics that we have remaining? I don't fully understand the import of the question about personal experience and growth, I must say. Who asked that yesterday? Who brought that up yesterday?
That was me, actually.
Okay. Would you like to say a bit more about it and see if we can pursue it?
You might be able to think of something more specific.
Well, I guess one of my expectations when I came was that we would talk. I didn't realize that we would talk more globally, and which has been wonderful to get that perspective. But I guess I had some hopes for some personal stories and some, just to see, I don't know exactly how to do that, but just to see, you know, what I experienced isn't that unusual as compared to somebody else's experience.
And we did that primarily the one evening.
There's a lot of telling of our stories.
I guess I was thinking more in terms of the cooperative power model that was drawn yesterday with the spiral, and looking at how that is, instead of looking so much as ourselves within the larger picture, look more on that interpersonal level, on how we incorporate that image into our daily sexual relationships.
I don't think you can do it if you are in an institutional structure that is not also built on the cooperative power model. I don't think we can separate our intimate lives from our public lives. And it's since the 19th century, heterosexual monogamy in the United States has gotten more and more and more and more and more privatized, as well as by virtue of oppression, gay life has had to be very privatized. Lesbian life has had to be very privatized. And that means that there is an incredible emotional burden, usually on a pair of people, that is grossly unfair to those people. No one human being can bear that much emotional weight from another. And so all of the injustice of our social structures with regard to power then are supposed somehow to be redeemed by this love relationship. And it's one of the reasons that many of these relationships end, because that pressure is too much. And I'll speak out of my own situation at these institutions rather than at Holden. When institutions are set up on zero-sum competitive power models, so that, for example, MDiv students at Harvard, no matter how much we talk about alternative models, still understand everything in terms of hierarchical competition, they tend, by and large, to express themselves sexually in the same way. And we sit in class and talk about the alternative models of power, of understanding power not as zero-sum competitive, but exponentially growing the more it's shared. And the same would be true of erotic pleasure. that erotic power in us, as Audre Lorde says, is not finite substance. We have infinite capacity if we trust our bodies. But we can't have that infinite capacity for erotic power expressing itself if we are closed down in competitive systems. So how can you have cooperative power in bed Saturday night and then go to church and hear a hierarchical model? So that's why I keep going back to the structure. I'm a social ethicist from the start to the end of it. And I think that we do ourselves a massive disfavor as individuals if we think somehow that we're supposed to embody the redeemed person as individuals. This book does not talk about redeemed individuals. This book talks about redeemed communities. And so I can say, well, Jesus has saved me, but if I still work at Harvard or Boston University or in a increasingly hierarchical church, which is now about the business of trying to find more layers of ministry so we can have more people in hierarchy, I mean, it sort of takes the zip out of Eros. The same thing in schools. You know, I would say if we want to improve sexuality for an agapeic, erotic, filial pleasure for the foreseeable future in the United States, we would change the model of elementary education.
In what way?
We'd make it cooperative. We would make the students agents of their own learning.
Oh, okay.
Which is what I do in feminist pedagogy, at least I try.
I think, though, I'm working
as a parent supporter to a school that is attempting that model in the public forum. And it's a wonderful school, but one of the things that's just come to me as a very tragic shock is that the people who are most adamantly opposed to that via public letters to the newspaper and everything else are fundamentalist Christians who are so afraid of cooperative learning that they have taken to the streets or anybody who will listen to them to tell the world how awful that model is. So how do we change it? Because I'm just struggling. How do we change it?
That reminds me, I really hope that you all sometime take a look at Greven's book. Philip, it's G-R-E-V-E-N, Spare the Child. And he talks about this fundamentalist, evangelical, Christian teaching that human will is so corrupted in the fall that it has to be forced into obedience. And you must discipline children into being obedient creatures, because by and large, all human beings are disobedient, Genesis 3. It's a very consistent theology in some fearful ways. And fundamentalist evangelical Christians in the United States hold that theology, that interpretation of the human will. And they hold that interpretation of God. They're very consistent. Their view of the human self and their view of God is a view of coercive power. And I think that they are very insightful people, because that model is exactly a threat, not only to their understanding of themselves, to their theology. And if liberals or moderates or whoever isn't in that group don't get our act together, we're going to be very surprised in the next election, because they're organizing across the country at the local level for school board elections. That's where it is. So I think that liberal Christians have too much individualistic autonomy in their visions of ourselves, and we don't organize.
Yeah.
Well, that'll get you a Jerry Falwell school board if you don't organize against it.
Well, I can see it happening, not very far from Holy Village.
Yeah.
So is your answer to me that feminist Christians, or Christians who believe in sort of a cooperative spirit, need to get politically organized? Is that the...
That's certainly an aspect of it, that all of the theory will sit there like a lump in the stomach. For feminist theology, the proof of the theology is in the justice it creates, not in its intellectual coherence. So when I start a feminist theology class at Harvard, I say the test of whether we're doing anything useful is, have we improved the well-being of women and children by the end of the semester? And I think that's a good test for the preaching of the gospel. And I think, and I know, because I've done the work, I know that that is consistent with Luther. That the test of the gospel is, what is the condition of the community with regard to justice? And I thought how marvelous it was at the Eucharist last night. Because that model of Luther is that you have the Eucharist in order to be fed for doing justice. So the Eucharist ends out in the streets, Luther said. It doesn't end in the church building. Because what the Eucharist says to you is, you must take on the condition of the worst off in the community. So that you go to your standard Lutheran congregation, how do you know if the gospel is being preached? You find out the condition of the people in the neighborhood who don't belong to the congregation. Mm-hmm. Or the people in the next neighborhood, because the neighborhoods are so segregated by money and by ethnicity and by race.
So I have found in my own personal life that I cannot do the work of the church in the church. I have to do the work of the church in the political arena.
Hallelujah, sister.
And I, but then... what I end up denying is, you know, I mean, I don't talk a lot about how my Christian faith impacts my action. You know, I know that.
And God knows that, so I talk about it.
Well, I feel bad because I'm not doing anything to help those fundamentalist Christians who've closed their mind to what I would believe anyway. And so I say, oh, well, to heck with that. I will just do what I know has to be done to accomplish the things I know need to be accomplished. But I haven't, they are, in the meantime, you know, gathering their reinforcements, and they're, you know, getting their Bible passages all in order and sending letters to the editor. And so this other Christian woman and I decided at the last letter to the editor, which was opposing the school that we support so strongly, to do nothing, because we said, you know, if we send another letter back to the editor, that gives them a forum to promote their cause. So we said, we will go about doing our work, we'll do it very quietly, we're going to ignore that and just do the best we can. But in the meantime, they are doing the best job they can of spreading word to everybody they know, and we're just doing the work of our cause.
But are you spreading the word about your cause?
In very quiet ways, because we don't want to bring in their wrath to close down what we're trying to do.
Yeah. Let me raise a possibility, and that is that liberals, and I mean that in a good sense, liberals in the church are very loath to engage conflict and have not much experience dealing constructively with our anger. So we tend to diffuse that, avoid conflict. And there's no way in the United States of America to get much done politically with that model. The model these days, whether we like it or not, is a conflict model for political action. And it might be right not to trigger more in this particular instance in the paper. But on the other hand, you could quietly go about what you're doing and find that it's insufficient. It's not public enough, you aren't getting enough numbers, you aren't getting enough money. And a lot of the work of God, Pharaoh wasn't exactly a member of the religious community. I mean, this is a story about politics, the Passover, and about economic well-being. And so is the one in Luke. That's what we keep forgetting. So is the story in Luke, a story about political and economic justice. So if you're out there doing that work, you are doing Christian work.
Part that really bothers me is that I'm not spreading the Christian message. In
yes.
Part, well,
yeah, but you're
spiritual questions about God.
Mm-hmm.
And I go daily through a struggle, learning a new understanding of theology. And it's the old understanding of theology. Namely, we never encounter God except in mediation. God always comes to human beings in physical forms somehow, like political systems. And you can't say, well, I've got a nice direct relationship with God and it has nothing to do with the political system, because God always operates through political systems. And the new version of my faith question is, how in the world do I pay more taxes? That's a faith question, not does God exist after a serious period of secularization? That was the way I learned it. The women from Korea at the Women's Theological Center tell us, the Europeans worry, does God exist? The Koreans worry, the Korean poor worry, is it possible for people to exist? And those are both theological questions, two very different systems of theology. Go ahead.
No, it's just,
I mean, in a sense, what we're talking about and the issues you've raised seem to me to be the dualism. I mean, maybe everybody else got this already, but that's it. Struck me as kind of body and spirit. We talk about faith and politics, or church and politics, as if they're separable things. And in fact, if our faith work is everything that we do, and I think from my own standpoint, my faith is diminished to the extent that I don't articulate my justice work as faith work. If I separate it and I don't want to impose my faith on others, I go about doing God's work in justice realms, but I don't explain my motivations, my theology, my background to people, so that what my friends who are not in a traditional sense churched understand as faith and religion is what they see from those who are pounding the Bible and preaching hate. And I want to get to a place where I can pose an alternative model for people that's very faith-based, because I think we need to be vocal. And I've learned not to be vocal, that my evangelism is not, it's a dirty word in that sense.
It's a dirty word because the model of evangelism that we have is the other model.
Right, mm-hmm. And I think we need to reclaim, I need to reclaim that.
Mm-hmm. What is the good news? Tell mm-hmm. people. By the way, the magazine Christianity in Crisis is folding, speaking of that voice. Mm-hmm. The attacks are pretty strong these days, I think. Mm-hmm. Is that clear what's going on in the conversation now? So that if you work for a battered women's shelter, you're doing the gospel. You're doing the gospel. For you? Go ahead.
I'd like to get back. To the question of our personal erotic relationships or whatever, and how you brought this up, but Elizabeth, you said you don't think we can have a cooperative power relationship until the institutions we're a part of and all that is more cooperative. And I'm wondering, though, is that just saying, well, we might as well give up on cooperative power, personal relationships, until we get everything settled out there, because then we'll never get there, and so we'll just end up having, bad personal relationships. Is it possible to work, to work simultaneously on the personal relationship and the societal problem, and energy from this personal relationship being effort toward a responsible, cooperative, mutually whatever relationship, giving you energy for the bigger battle and the bigger societal problem, giving you energy for that, or... I hate to leave it at, well, you can't have a good, right relationship in your personal life until these societal problems are solved. Please.
No, I think your point is well taken, that it's possible to work on both simultaneously. My caution is against the dominant understanding in the society of isolated, intimate relationships. And I think that I think that females are especially prone to this in our society, because we've learned a model of romantic love that has built into it a perfectionist strand, and we think it's our fault if this perfectionist romantic love doesn't work. And we forget that we live in structures and systems which daily undercut our efforts at loving with integrity. So you get women who feel very guilty, whether they're in lesbian relationships, whether they're in bi relationships, whether they're in straight relationships, who feel tremendously guilty because perfection hasn't happened here in Eden. And they forget that this couple goes out and works in a system which is the antithesis of what they're trying to do personally. And so this will get more and more and more horribly painful unless this changes. But I think you're right. We can't just accede to that and say, well, it's horrible forever. But I would add something, and I'm glad that you said it helps me remember more than I was. To do the work of personal relationship, to try to obtain an egalitarian, equitable, cooperating power, is also a political act. So the politics isn't only here. It's a subversion of the dominant view to create the alternative anywhere. Is that plausible?
Mm-hmm. I'd like to add too that it's very obvious, I think, among men that there's a real strong emasculinization of men that is making this process very difficult. You know, because of the, all these systems. Like I said, I'm searching for something here that it takes both the men and the women, it's like, say, in a cooperation, in a relationship. And the men right now are getting battered in a way that probably they never have before. Now, some women, of course, smile at this, and I can really understand that, too, because for years they've been shit on. But it's making it difficult, and until I'm thinking here especially of my Indian brothers, until they become more healthy, until they become men again, in the best sense of the word, it's going to be impossible for the women on the reservation to find what they deserve, what we all deserve. And so there's that real difficult time right now we're going through about boys not knowing who they are anymore. And I guess I would answer maybe part of the puzzle, you know, would be that none of us will ever have this in total balance. But we pray and we hope that the community will have all the parts that we can every once in a while realize the ideal. And I think that's, you know, what I would, you know, look for as far as practical application of the things that we've heard this weekend, is to try to maintain as best as I can an openness to the balance in the community and the pieces in the community that can make us whole. And I just have to struggle and stumble forward, you know, to pray, to be open, to be balanced myself, to hike, to do art, to study, to pray, and to try to put as much of it together as I can. I don't know if that does anything, but at least it airs some of my thoughts. Anyway.
It does a lot, because I think a lot of the people sitting here, including myself, need practical applications and thoughts about all the things that we've discussed. Yesterday, watching the
Have a friend thought about it?
Watching that video, the one about the perfect woman, a woman gorging herself, the words that were displayed as fast as they could go, you probably couldn't have time to put all the words that could really reflect what was going on in that video. The expectations for girls, for women. I think about my own daughter, who's 10, walking into that age when they're so influenced by these things. And I could go back to that time of being young and being so influenced by the vision of what I was supposed to look like and putting on these things.
mini skirts and nylons and high heels and makeup and my long hair. I'd feel good momentarily or whatever for the vision that I saw in the mirror. That's as deep as it went. And I'd take that vision out. And what I got back was something I couldn't handle. When I think back, you know, sexually, you put yourself out there and you don't even, and you walk yourself into situations, sexual situations, and then that you set yourself up for, in a sense, but you didn't know what you were doing at the time. And you're left with emptiness and guilt and several things. And practical application for me now would be a social justice issue would be to, for children and young boys and girls is to get rid of that false image of what we have to look like or supposed to look like. It's just so destructive.
Yeah, it's very powerful insight. And that sometimes you can tell when you're on to the right direction in sexual ethics by the tears. Mm-hmm. The passion, the caring is indicative that points to the road. And let's ask, where do girls in this culture hear an alternative vision? Some other than what the media portray. Who tells
exactly.
Girls?
Well. Damn well better be their mothers, I hope, starting at home and the comfort that you bring to your children.
How about church? Is it ever discussed in church? No. And why not?
Well, I've been at church a lot, so maybe they
Well, you know who does discuss that are the fundamentalist groups. Because when I was in college, I belonged to this group called Campus Crusade for Christ for 1 year. And all the women in our particular group went to this weekend kind of retreat that they called a feminar. Instead of a seminar, they called it a feminar. And they pulled all these Bible verses out and told us how to dress, how to wear our makeup, how to treat our boyfriends. So they are doing it.
I have a friend that had a friend of hers that came out to her as a gay man. And she was really struggling with this, and she's a member of a fundamentalist church. And her pastor said, do you think that you're really struggling with this because you might have some question about your own identity? And she was like, oh my gosh, you know, how could he ever bring anything like this up? So he said, well, I'll set you up with this woman who can help you become more feminine. Mm-hmm. And so she got connected with this woman. They went out and they bought feminine clothes, and she got a perm in her hair, and she learned how to use makeup, and she thinks she's set in that. In that, ugh.
But if we didn't have those standards, the economy of the United States would collapse.
Billionaires.
That's right.
We need to tell our young boys that that's too, you know, that those girls on the TV screen can be their sisters. And do you want somebody to look at your sister that way or think what you're thinking right now of your sister? Just to make it more real to them. To look at people and treat people with respect.
I think we there aren't in the church visions of beautiful female bodies. There's Mary in Roman tradition, but think of Protestant congregations. Where are the visions of beautiful female bodies in our religious traditions? We have nothing to set up over against the capitalist patriarchal model of what females are. So it doesn't become an issue of faith for little, for 9-year-olds or 14-year-olds. We never talk about it that way. That the dignity of the female body is a question of faith.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that a lot of that is, or I'll speak for myself, that is a white church speaking when you say that?
I know it's the white church speaking, and I don't know whether the same happens in congregations that are not white.
Well,
I know something actually from some friends that there are some similarities.
Yeah, the little contact that I have with a black church, I'd say that it isn't the same. That black women are, even though they have to fight the Aunt Jemima thing, are far more comfortable with their bodies. No?
I think it's a white stereotype.
Mm-hmm. Well,
but you don't, so let's talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I think black people in general are more comfortable with their bodies.
No, it's also a stereotype.
I think that's blacks are closer to nature, women are closer to nature.
Oh, I don't think that. Like monkeys, you mean, or that?
No. Well, whites have called that stereotype too. But the tradition of hierarchical dualism in the West has claimed that women are more embodied than men are, and whites have claimed that blacks are more embodied than whites are, because the white norm there is the white male mind.
Maybe I haven't thought of completely, but
I think there's just tremendous diversity in every ethnic and racial group.
I noticed that when you go to predominantly black church that people dress up, and I always wondered why that was. I mean, why women dress up. And they do it, I was told by a black woman that they do it because they're in their God's house, and they are dressing up because they like themselves. They like their bodies. They like themselves. And that's why they do it. They make a point of doing it.
If that's the case, great cause for celebration.
Mm-hmm. I think also, not so much white, but American versus European. I mean, just thinking that made me think of children's dolls, something as supposedly innocent as that, and how until recently we didn't have any genitals on children's dolls, and where, I mean, that sounds silly, but in Europe they had, and they didn't have little Barbie dolls, they would have, you know, round grandma dolls too, and how, at least in the generation when I was growing up, it was very much Barbie, and that's the bodies we were showing, those bodies look like, as far as with the image.
She's up in the attic right now.
I was worked in D.C. and I worked with, at an all-African American church and all-African American neighborhood. And I think that black women, as young girls, know they don't want to look like Barbie, but they do want to look like the women on the butt video. That we saw babies got back, and they and if they're not heavy enough, they feel like shit, just like white women who are not thin enough feel like shit. And a funny example of that was, there was a white woman who worked at our agency of St. Olaf, and she was heavy, and the women loved her, the girls loved her. They'd say, "Oh, you got such pretty big legs." And she, and it just bugged her. She just hated it because she didn't want to be played. So I think the I'm not sure how to put it. I think the symptoms are the same. It's just that what people want.
Well, I'm just a simple person from Wilmer, Minnesota. I remember watching the 700 Club and Tammy Baker, you know, with her bangles and earrings.
And
I thought, is that a Christian model? Well, me look like that, you know, and so I just had to turn that off. I couldn't, because I couldn't compete with that. And then I think too, I get real upset when my little granddaughter comes and she's got earrings on, and I tell my daughter, you know, why don't you let them be? You want them to be grown up when they're little babies wearing them. Being, you know, why don't you let them grow up and be clean-faced and run and play and not worry about nylons and all this at such a young age? And I think that's the fault of a lot of mothers. They want their kids to be growing up before they're even, I mean, they don't even know that they're little girls. They're supposed to be. But I get real upset with it. And then I want to thank you when you said something about the battered women, because working with the battered women, because we were a safe home for battered women, and Wilmer finally got a home for battered women, and then my husband and I, we stayed overnight because they needed somebody at night, and finally they got volunteers to come in. But I used to drive women to court and drive them home to another town, and the police would meet us, and, oh, you know. So I'm thinking, well, maybe I've done something.
It's doing the good news.
I just wanted to point out that the word father has not come up at all in this discussion. That when we talk about parents and their parents' responsibilities and the way that a mother should do this for her children and a mother should do that, I know that a lot of times the mother is the one saddled with the responsibility of raising the children, but are we perpetuating that by not mentioning fathers and the role that fathers should play?
Yeah, that's
right.
And usually the father is at home, he's working, and that's the way, but now we're all working, but I know, the father is supposed to be the breadwinner and, the hierarchy, come home and expect people to wait on him.
And that's still perpetuated by society. If you go to the brand new Safeway in Wenatchee, the diaper changing station is in the women's bathroom, not in the men's bathroom.
Yeah.
There's not one in the men's.
Just you checked it out.
Checked it out.
My son and daughter-in-law, yeah. They just amaze me. They're really doing a terrific job. And I think that's the way it's going to have to be. The husband is going to have to help take care of the woman.
Yeah,
at kind of an equal basis.
And equal means in this case that men often have to give up a lot of their privilege. Mm-hmm. And that's very threatening. It's like whites giving up privilege on race issues, the rich giving up privilege on money issues. We have to have less power in order for equality to take place. And that's, this book is immensely helpful. Because Jesus talks about that all the time. If you want to be part of the community of heaven, give up all this privilege.
Are you suggesting that trickle-down economics don't work very well?
Not so.
I'll take the mighty streams of justice anyway. The frail male ego is a theme coming up again and again and again, and it's the frail white ego, too, on race issues, and the frail ego of the affluent on class issues. The frail ego of straight people. Yeah. I mean, just look at the discussion about the military now. That's a bunch of frail egos. In the other dimensions of this, there's no neat way ever to bring this to conclusion, so we can just sort of dribble on. Go ahead.
My daughter is 7, and...
what's her name?
Holly.
Holly?
Yes.
Beautiful.
And she's tall, she's big. She's a big girl, and I can't even believe that I birthed her. And the thing is, you know, we may talk about trying to change people's attitudes, or, you know, the Barbie syndrome, or the Cinderella syndrome and all that, but I'm telling you, it is very difficult to fight it, because every night, it goes through phases where my daughter will cry and say, oh, they called me fat today, Mom, and she will cry herself. Now, I will try and heal her and say, oh, honey, you're such a person of value. I value you, and you know, try not to let it hurt you so much and things. And then she gets up the next day, and she puts her clothes on, and she goes back to school, and she's faced with it again. There's just, you know, it's like if you're even the tiniest bit different, or the tiniest bit big, or your teeth don't come in straight, or something like that, and it wouldn't surprise me if my daughter is going to be on one of those bulimic shows or anorexic shows, and I don't know how to. And even my husband, when I left, we're at the dinner table, and he goes, and Holly, while your mom's gone, we're going to deal with this diet issue. You know what I mean? And I try to tell, and I am trying to fight these things for her, because here is, and he says, well, what about her self-esteem? You can't let her grow up like that, because she will have no self-worth. And, you know, how is society going to accept her? So, you know, it's very real in my home, and, you know, I'm trying to heal her, but it's hard. And I talked to the teacher, and she's not obese. She's tall, and she's big, and to me, she's very beautiful, but she's got a hard road, and it's not that easy for anybody who's the tiniest bit different.
And I think you have just named the key. Though once again, the educational system doesn't deal with the problems of difference. And I just said that wrongly. I just made a mistake. Doesn't deal with difference. It construes difference as a problem. And the pressure to be alike is not only among the kids, because it's certainly there, but they learn it. And the educational model is the model of conformity. Make all these children learn the same thing in the same way. So the children don't learn how to deal with difference and celebrate it. They're taught the opposite, and so they're behaving as they were taught. So I would say in a situation like that, part of the problem is that we're all overworked and overburdened, because now I'm going to make a suggestion about some more work. But I would say, ask other parents that you may know from that class, are there other characteristics that stand out for that group as different? Can you work with the teacher to set up sessions in class? And it can be in mathematics, it can be in reading, where the children explicitly deal with the question of what does it mean to be different. And there are wonderful children's books these days that do that. Just wonderful books. Because otherwise she'll fight, the battle can't be fought head on just this issue. Because it's not the issue of body size simply, it's the issue of difference. Yes, yes. But how lucky she is to have you for her mother. Go on.
Something just occurred to me while we were talking. You mentioned that liberals don't organize. I think one of the reasons liberal Christians don't organize is because liberal Christians were usually the different people who were beat up when they were growing up. And, you know, because everybody else learned how to fit in. You know, the conservative people, they did whatever they had to do to fit in, whether that means plastic surgery, whether that means whatever that means, they did, you know.
Yeah.
But those of us who were liberal Christians were the people who were probably wounded Christians,
yeah.
You know, because we didn't fit in. So the last thing we want to do is get into another conflict, because someone might call us being or stupid, or you know, they might point out, yeah, point out our differences, you know, and so and it, that just when she was talking, that just really came out to me because I, you know, the reason I had to go into, I was very different growing up in school, and I think Holden is a place where these different Christians get together. And you know, in the winter community, to put it mildly, you know, by the mainstream Lutheran church, they're considered flaky.
Good.
Ripping the head off of a nobody's gonna buy that outside of it. And something that happens to us is when people come up for the summer, you get all the mainline Christians who come up for the summer, and it becomes, there's just a big gap. There are those of us who've been here all winter, who have been empowered by having to do our own vespers and matins all winter long, and being feeling okay now about expressing where we come from. And then we have the mainline people who say it's got to be this way. There's kind of a battle that goes on, and usually centers around inclusive language. You know, that's kind of the battlefield. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. It just occurred to me when she was talking why liberal Christians don't fight, why mm-hmm. we don't like fighting.
That's very
helpful.
I hated recess.
Yeah.
Tossing that bat to see who would pick first. Oh, that whole that. But on the other hand, the oppressed, if at least the different, if not the oppressed, could still now find common cause, couldn't they?
Well, we could, but I don't think we want to bring up those issues. You know, I mean, I don't want to reach back and pull up my recess from growing up. I mean, those same experience, shirts and skins, and being the last one picked for a team, all of that kind of stuff. I mean, organized, you kind of have to, you know, relive some of that.
Yeah.
Well, then, you know, for the kids that are going through that now, well, you know, to hear someone like you, I have a son that goes through that. So. You know, if he could hear you say, and then, I'm sorry, I can't do it. But it would mean a lot.
Another rule in the new sexual ethics is you never have to apologize for tears.
But I have to say, I don't know if I have the guts to stand up in front of a group kids and say, I didn't fit in, you know, because you work so hard. I don't work to fit in anymore. I kind of work to not draw attention to myself so people won't say, well, he doesn't fit in. So it's a weird thing, but another thing that came to my mind is last summer a guy was up here, and he was talking about youth at risk, because that's what he does in Portland, and he was saying, what other people have said, he said that the KKK and white supremacist groups and military groups, they take youth and they teach them. They teach the boys how to be men, you know, in the sense that what we, all the things that are supposed to be men, you know, the powers. And so I guess you're right. And, well, I know you're right in the sense that we need to give our children attention. Because that's what the competition is, the conservatives and the right-wingers and the kind of lonely people, they're doing all, you know.
Conservative Christians and conspicuous consumption capitalists.
Yeah.
Those are the two major sources of lies.
Conservative Christians and conspicuous capitalists?
Conspicuous consumption capitalists.
Consumption.
How do we know that we have dignity? Well, for a lot of us, it's our possessions in this society. How much we consume. So you have to defend yourself if you don't yet have a microwave. Really?
Right.
And that is playing into that same problem that we're talking about for our children.
I was just thinking when people have been talking about their children, they made a point before about how the impossibility or the pressure that's put on people, two people in a sexual relationship, to try to be the redemptive model when they're living under a rock, essentially. And I've had this image of like a vice grip or a rock that is that we're living under in terms of our sexual relationships, but also in terms of our relationships with our children. And it's wonderful to try to be struggling to present alternative models, but for me there's some sense of relief in the realization that I'm under this rock, and that's why it feels like this. And that it's not that I can do all I can in my own interpersonal relationships or with children or in sexual relationships, but that I'm still under this rock. And to the extent that I can creep out or move it a little, you know, so be it, that's my life's work, but that it's there, and there's something I need to just feel that. So that it's not all the pressure that's there to change it. Anyway,
do you remember that early slogan in the early feminist movement? I was very depressed until I realized I was oppressed. Which says the same thing.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Right.
I have a bit of a hard time with talking about the liberals organizing. Because when I think of the religious right organizing, I think of very I have a very negative image of that. And it's almost like the liberals organizing, it's like pulling in the troops to fight the battle, in the sense that it's kind of like, you know, the liberals gaining ground to fight the religious right. And I know that's not necessarily what's happening, and that's not the intent, is to fight the other side, but it's
yes,
almost...
It is.
That's
my intention.
I don't like the imagery of that, though. Now, for some reason, it always conjures that up for me.
No, we can't choose. Sometimes we can't choose our imagery. I mean, if they are declaring war, you can't say. If you say I refuse to engage the war, you are turning power over to them to define what justice is.
Uh-huh. How does that fit in with cooperative power?
Cooperative power is still what you aspire to create on planet Earth. But that doesn't mean that you have the leisure, the privilege of using means consistent with that end all the time. I think that's one of the most invidious mm-hmm. teachings of traditional
huh.
ethics.
Huh. And, so we don't need, you're saying liberals who are organizing against the religious right don't need to practice a cooperative power system in order to overcome that hierarchical power?
Well, I think in the organizing process, if we practice cooperative power, we will be politically more effective as
okay.
a unit.
Okay.
But we can't say we're going to cooperate with those who have declared war on us.
Gotcha.
Okay.
See, I agree with that. It's just I agree wholeheartedly that liberals need to go together and work towards that. It's just that I do have that remnant of that struggle.
It's conflict.
Exactly.
I mean, and that we're all raised. We are. I was. I would assume a lot of people in this room were raised to avoid conflict,
right.
Especially in the church. Especially in the church. If we aspire, if we can change it to a model we're actually aspiring to do, because conflict can be done in a constructive,
nonviolent way.
Yeah, it doesn't. We don't have to. I don't think we used to have to use hateful tactics, which is what you're seeing from the other side.
On the other hand, conflict can entail serious violence. Witness the crucifixion.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And those prayers in Gethsemane were,
right.
This cup from me.
Right.
Get me out of this conflict.
Right.
Is what take this cup from me means.
Sin is ugly. Sin is ugly.
Okay, we are going to come to a 2-minute conclusion to this, my friends. Although I don't know that you're all my friends. Why do I use that language? How do you think we can bring this to some sense of getting up with equanimity and going on with our lives after this retreat? Any suggestions out of the group?
Hmm.
for me, it's just one personal commitment to do something about the conflict that I talked about earlier.
It would be very helpful if we each just quickly said one concrete thing that we think we might be able to do by virtue of being who we are right now.
Well, Eric Holden has been really a revealing experience for me, because I wrote a letter to my daughter and I said, "You'd never believe your mother." Because here I feel myself, I want to express myself, and I haven't been shot down for being myself. The way I feel inside, I like cats. And I have tried, when I go walking, I have tried to wear a cap, but before long I've taken it off, you know, because all these women that I see walking, they've got a perfect suit on, and they, you know, their hair is the makeup, and I come like this. I feel like it's okay. And so now I've been empowered here, and it's my prayer that when I go home, I don't lose what I found. That I can go on and be myself and not try to collect points and be a big deal.
Now you just find the three or four others who are like you in that neighborhood, and you will have a goal.
Yeah. We've got two right here with us.
And she just got right. Her hat, too.
That's a marvelous high note. And, are there any other things that people want to say?
I want to thank you for helping me to think beyond the Bible. That has been the revelation for me this week. I always felt that there's this inner God that had nothing to do with the relationship of the Bible. And yet my Catholic upbringing, of course it had no Bible in it, but it was all catechism. But when I started to look at the Bible, something didn't fit, and I was never quite sure why. There was a spirituality, my spirituality and the Bible were like not always working together. And when you talked about life before the Hebrews and the Bible, it's like, of course. So thank you for, you know, putting that aha there for me to go on and look at beyond the Bible. Thanks.
Thank you for being part of the aha. Any other? Yes.
I must tell you, I've enjoyed every moment of your talks. And I am going to go home and take with me, and I hope I can figure out how to do this, because I firmly believe I want to be a Bible-based person, being raised with no values, no nothing. And I'm hoping that I can make my Bible, for me, expand to be more compassionate and to be just a little bit more understanding of my own ways. You know, there's a lot more out there, and so that's what I'm going to do.
Take a companion with you. Take some of the work of Letty Russell on the Bible.
Letty Russell.
She's a feminist liberation interpreter from New Haven. She writes some wonderfully direct studies of how to read the Bible as a... Hmm.